Welcome to part two of a special podcast series from Finnegan, breaking down the Federal Circuit's first decision regarding derivation proceedings under the America Invents Act. The episode features a conversation between Finnegan attorneys Jeff Totten and Alyssa Green. Jeff, a partner, focuses on trial-level patent and trade secret litigation and PTAB proceedings. He has represented clients in inventorship disputes in both district court and the PTAB. Jeff regularly counsels clients regarding derivation and correction of inventorship proceedings. Alyssa, an associate, focuses on patent litigation before U.S. District Court and the International Trade Commission. She has represented clients in inventorship disputes in District Court, the ITC, and the PTAB. Alyssa also counsels clients on navigating the interplay between the various forums and on best practices for avoiding derivations and other inventorship disputes.
Hi again, Alyssa. We're here to talk about the Federal Circuit decision in Global Health Solutions, the Cellner, again, as well as its implications for derivations and how the PTAB approaches those. In our first episode, we talked about what a derivation is and why Global Health Solutions is the first Federal Circuit case involving derivation proceedings. Now, we'll turn to best practices for avoiding and litigating derivation claims in view of this decision. Can you tell us some common scenarios in which derivation issues can arise?
Sure, Jeff. These derivation scenarios come up more often than you might think. Some examples would be where there's a customer and a supplier, engineer and contractor, joint development agreements, trade secret licenses, you may have a former employee who is left that collaborated. Sometimes it's just informal collaboration or during peer review. So Jeff, given how frequently these scenarios pop up, do you have any tips for how you can preemptively avoid a derivation?
Yes, this really comes down to clarity in relationships. We can think about it in the employer-employee context that you mentioned. In that case, the best practice is going to be to clearly establish who in that arrangement, that relationship, has ownership of IP that's developed, as well as filing authority over any inventions that are developed by the employee, making sure the employee understands that the employer owns certain IP rights that are developed during the relationship, similar to what we see in the trade secrets context. That extends to the other common fact patterns that you mentioned. You can view it in terms of licensee, licensor for trade secrets or patent rights. What happens to further developments in that relationship and trying to make that clear in the contract language. Also, thinking about revisiting those contracts from time to time as the relationship develops and time goes on so that the parties remember where ownership lies and there aren't surprises. So often these derivation disputes arise out of a surprise. Two parties that have been working together and then one goes to the patent office and files for a patent application and the other says, wait a minute, that was my idea, and under our contract, I should own that. So often these arise out of situations where the parties either have an agreement or don't have the necessary agreement in place, but sort of forget who contributed to what and who owns what.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I mean, I think what we saw from the Global Health v. Cellner case is that evidence is key, and that would include these agreements that you were just talking about. And although those are important and may help clarify early disputes between those parties, once it gets to the actual dispute and possibly a derivation, things are really going to hinge on these records of conception, records of disclosure, and witnesses to corroborate, which we talked about on the previous episode.
Yeah, so if we're looking at records of conception, records of disclosure, witnesses, email, those sort of things from the co-development go a long way to showing who contributed what to the application that was later filed. Did the Global Health v. Cellner case tell us anything about the evidence needed for derivations, Alyssa?
It did. And I think more than anything, it emphasize the importance of corroborating evidence to support the derivation claims. And in this case, everything hinged on a string of emails. And the court found that these string of emails were sufficient for the board's finding of no derivation. And so again, I think this all really comes back to dotting I's and crossing T's for having evidence and contracts if the collaboration is really in play.
It also highlights a little bit about the importance that still remains in inventor notebooks. And I know that after the first to file framework went into place with the AIA, some parties may not be putting as much importance into notebooks or electronic notebooks as they once did. However, these types of disputes illustrate that that type of record keeping can still be important in addition to helping you present your inventions when you get to district court litigation, if you're trying to assert one of your patents, but it also can have value in a situation like this where there's a dispute about who invented what.
That's right, Jeff. Again, I think everything comes back to needing good evidence to support your case and corroborating evidence either through witnesses or written documentation. So Jeff, if someone thinks that they have enough facts to support filing a derivation, what should they know before they decide to file?
It's a great question, Alyssa. This is somewhat similar to an IPR or PGR, other types of PTAB proceedings, same board that's going to be hearing your derivation claim. Like those other cases, you want all of the evidence that we mentioned in that initial petition. The derivation proceeding is going to be judged on that initial petition, and the board will decide whether or not to institute based on what you put into the petition. So frequently you will see parties attaching emails like the ones we saw in the global health case. We'll see parties attaching affidavits or declarations from witnesses who are involved in the communication, the conception of the communication, and that also corroborate that communication and conception. And those records will go in with the petition and the petition will refer to them, often along with an expert declaration to help tie the conception and communication to the claims. So we kind of see through that answer, what I like to call the four C's of derivation: conception, communication, corroboration, and of course the claimed invention. Those are the four C's that the parties are looking to and the board is looking to decide whether or not the derivation should be instituted. And all four should show up in your petition. You want that to be well done so it presents your case as best you can to the board.
Jeff, you mentioned that the board that hears derivations is the same board that hears IPRs and PGRs. Are there any other differences between derivations and IPRs and PGRs?
One big one is that IPRs and PGRs have a statutory timeline. Those will finish in about 18 months after institution. They may be extended a little bit, but typically, in nearly all cases, they're done within 18 months. Derivations can drag on. The board doesn't have a timeline that it's statutory held to. In fact, it doesn't make its institution decision within 6 months. It frequently waits until one of the parties has allowable subject matter before taking jurisdiction over the case and deciding the derivation claim. It doesn't want to consider cases where it's not even clear whether either party's claims will issue. Rather, it waits until we've got some clarity on patentability and then picks up the petition at that point in time. So those are some big differences that parties can sometimes be surprised about when they first start thinking about filing a derivation claim. So in view of the challenges involved in presenting this information to the PTAB and timelines and other limitations, Lisa, are there other alternatives filings that parties should be thinking about if they're looking at a derivation situation?
There are, Jeff, and it really is going to, again, hinge on the specific facts and evidence that the parties have available to them. But one way, if there's not a big dispute, is to just simply correct inventorship through 35 U.S.C. 256, which allows you to add a co-inventor. There's also the ability to file a trade secret suit. However, this is going to require misappropriation or some sort of wrongdoing to get that invention. One of the most common things that we see instead of a derivation is a breach of contract. Jeff had previously discussed different types of contracts that we see depending on collaborations or working agreements. And if a party breaches one of those, then you can go to court with any kind of breach of contract claim. I think the main thing to know about breach of contract is that there needs to be some sort of damages associated with it, which that may not be known at the time of filing this invention, whether there's anything, you know, profitable. And then finally, there's also shop rights and obligations to assign.
Yeah, we sometimes see employers just asking for shop rights in the invention developed by an employee, or asking the employee to assign the invention over based on the employment agreement. Can you tell us a little bit more about correcting inventorship under Section 256? Is that the same as a derivation?
So it's not the same as a derivation. Given that derivations are an America Invents Act process, there are some changes that we saw in the statute for patents under 35 U.S.C. 102. So when we went to the first to file versus first to invent, 102F, which used to be the cause of action for incorrect inventorship for invalidity purposes, is no longer part of the AIA statute. And so we still have 35 U.S.C. 256, which allows for correction of inventorship. And in this case, it's whenever through error a person is named an issued patent as the inventor, or through error an inventor is not named in the issue patent. The director may, on application of all the parties and assignees, again, they're going to need proof of facts and other such requirements, they can issue a certificate correcting that error. And so I think one thing to think about for 256, as I said several times, is this is really about an error, not necessarily some sort of misappropriation. And the big thing to consider, which is very different than what we saw pre-AIA, is there's no clear invalidity or unenforceability claim for incorrect inventorship. Like I mentioned, pre-AIA, you could claim invalidity of a patent for incorrect inventorship under 35 U.S.C. 102F. Currently, the courts are divided as to whether there's any statute in the AIA that allows for claims of invalidity or unenforceability due to incorrect inventorship.
Parties are still arguing unenforceability due to inequitable conduct and purposefully misrepresenting an inventor. But as you note, those cases are still working their way through the court system, right?
That's right. And we've seen cases be brought under 101 for that. We've also seen 35 U.S.C. 115 try to be used. But the courts are split and they're really not sure how they're going to handle this. So I would expect in the next couple of years, the Federal Circuit will likely weigh in if a case gets that far. Something else about 256 is, although you typically see it in the context of parties that agree to add an inventor through error, if it's disputed, a party can also file a private right of action to correct that inventorship. And again, this would be brought in district court, and the burden would be clear and convincing evidence. And of course, there's also the option of during prosecution relying on 35 U.S.C. 116 to petition to add another inventor or correct inventorship.
So again, if all the parties are in agreement, you can just petition the director to change that inventorship if everyone's in agreement, right?
That's right. If everyone's in agreement, I think we really aren't reaching these contentious derivation proceedings or some of the other district court proceedings that I previously mentioned. So Jeff, given all of these various causes of action and the burden of filing a derivation, What are some considerations that a party should think about when deciding the appropriate forum or cause of action to try to correct an inventorship?
This is a tough situation. Frequently, you have one of your technical team coming in to the in-house counsel's office or outside counsel and saying, hey, this other party took our invention. We told them about it, and then they filed their own patent. And the attorney is left with, where is it going to be best for us to file this from a practical standpoint, from a cost standpoint, and from a likelihood of prevailing standpoint? Those answers aren't always clear. Sometimes it can be easier to file in district court to show joint inventorship. It requires a showing of that the parties were working together, but not that a single party conceived of and communicated the entire invention like a derivation does. However, district court has a higher standard of proof than a derivation proceeding and will likely cost more to take a case to conclusion, certainly if it goes through trial. You know, derivations have a very low filing fee. They are not easy to prepare as for the reasons we've discussed. However, they are still more cost-effective than district court. No parties have been successful in derivation proceedings to date, and they're rarely filed. So that tells us that parties are looking to alternate means for resolving these common disputes. Most likely, we're seeing most of these situations dealt with via trade secret or contract disputes, given the rarity of 256 actions as well. The burdens of proof are really difficult for some parties, and there's a natural skepticism from both courts and the board when parties coming before them and saying, hey, that patent that's been found allowable or been allowed, I really was the brains behind that, and you should assign it over to me or add me as a co-inventor. You know, they really want to confirm that that's what the evidence shows and that a correction should be made.
So Jeff, given everything we've discussed and the global health decision, what do you think are the key takeaways from that decision?
Yeah, so you know, global health confirmed for us that derivations differ from interferences, the regime that was in place before the AIA, but that conception and corroboration remain important to showing invention. So to establish inventorship, you are going to need to show that you conceived of the claimed invention, and you are going to have to show that there is corroboration for that conception, as well as the communication to the other party. So the Federal Circuit decision has confirmed the manner in which the board has approached these derivation proceedings, looking at conception as a key proof, as well as the requirement of corroboration of that conception. Also, given that this is the first Federal Circuit decision on derivations, it again confirms that while this is a common fact pattern, the proofs that parties need to show for derivations can be challenging and not make parties pursue that relief. That's not really in the text of the decision, but it's just an important thing to think about at this point in time. I think the third thing that we can take from this is that parties should be careful in considering the evidence available when deciding whether to pursue derivations or one of these other claims, looking to how much evidence they have available and whether they think it will suffice. Of course, in these types of disputes, you may not know what the other party is holding. You may not know what evidence they have about their conception and reduction to practice of the invention. And that was what really came up in the global health decision, where emails only a few hours before the alleged communication, slightly before the alleged communication, were sufficient to show a independent conception. So in sum, look at your evidence carefully, consider whether you can show conception and communication and corroborate that and consider both derivations and alternative ways of resolving your dispute.
Thanks, Jeff. Those are some interesting takeaways. And always, it's been fun to discuss these rare proceedings that are derivations and alternate ways that maybe you can challenge incorrect inventorship.
Thanks a lot. It was a nice reminder of this area of the case law and an opportunity to discuss it. Thanks again.
You've been listening to Jeff Totten and Alyssa Green of Finnegan, one of the largest IP law firms in the world. For more commentary on intellectual property news and issues, to listen to other podcasts, and to receive additional information on the firm, please visit www.finnegan.com. Thank you for listening to this podcast from Finnegan.